This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Have you ever seen an Ender Dragon or mined for redstone? Now, if what I've said makes sense to you, you're probably a Minecraft fan or the parent of one. And that game has caught the eyes of thousands of kids. They can spend hours creating 8-bit worlds or searching YouTube to watch other kids play the game. It's probably worse than your Candy Crush addiction. But Minecraft is not so mindless. Some teachers are using Minecraft in the classroom. And this fall, Microsoft bought the popular game and launched a Minecraft education website for teachers. So how can Minecraft and other games be useful educational tools? And I'd like to know, do you use Minecraft? Let us know. What do you think? Give us a call. Our number 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Bruce Homer is an associate professor of educational psychology at the City University of New York, right here in New York City. He came down a few floors to join us in our CUNY studios. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Zach Klein is CEO of DIY.org and co-founder of Vimeo. He's based out of San Francisco, California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi.
Zach, let me ask you, for those of us who are newbies to the game, I have to put myself in that category, how does Minecraft work? How do you play the game?
So I'm sure if you haven't heard of Minecraft, you've definitely heard of Lego. And oh, yeah. Minecraft is basically virtual Legos, except you can have an infinite number of blocks to play with. And instead of just being plastic, the blocks can have different properties. They can be stone, they can be wood, they can be water, they can be shrubs. And kids play with them just like they might with Legos. They build anything they can imagine, and they can do it in a space with other kids online.
Now, I'm a SimCity veteran, though.
That's how I grew up, too.
Yeah. How similar is it to SimCity?
Well, it's different than SimCity in that there aren't necessarily... there isn't a game engine that's simulating civilization. You are in a world that's empty, except for the other players that are playing with you, and you're building objects.
Now, Bruce, I know there are teachers out there that are using Minecraft in their lesson plans. What kind of lessons?
It's amazing how many different types of lessons have been built around Minecraft. Everything from the arts to history to geography.
Is that right? So you can build anything you can think of?
Yes. I mean, the teachers, I've developed a whole online community where they build these virtual worlds and have certain activities that students do, and they share them with each other.
And Zach, what kind of Minecraft projects are kids posting on the DIY.org site?
So it's pretty interesting how I discovered it. DIY is at its core, a portfolio service for kids. So kids can create a portfolio and upload anything they do or that they've made or they're interested in. And last year, we introduced search to our site. So I spent an entire day just searching different keywords. And I searched for architecture. And I looked at the results. And I found that most of the projects that had been uploaded to portfolios were buildings designed in Minecraft. And it occurred to me that kids weren't using this game as a game necessarily. They were using it as a new kind of tool that allowed them to 3D model.
Bruce, you're shaking your head at this, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Minecraft, I wouldn't even call it a game. I would call it maybe a toy. It's a virtual world, and what you do with it is infinite. And a lot of what kids have done, they've built games that they share with each other. Mm-hmm. So it's really an open-ended platform that has lots of potential.
So why are video games such a good medium for learning? What kind of thinking skills can kids learn from video games?
Well, video games, the way they're built, tap into, I think, a lot of key features that address who children are and what they like. So they're interactive, they're social, and you know, visually and emotionally stimulating. And there's learning in every video game. The key is to develop games that kids can actually learn stuff that we want them to learn from.
Zach, I'm going to guess that you like me were a geeky kid growing up, and you played.
Absolutely, yeah. I lived and died by Lego and SimCity.
Yeah, let's go to the phones. Let's see who we've got. Let's go to Robert in Ventura, California. Hi, Robert.
Hey there, Ira. I'm so glad you're having this conversation.
Thank you.
Minecraft is a great thing. I've been using it for my students to teach a lot of cultural literacy, actually, about ecology ancient philosophy and American government and politics.
No kidding.
Yeah. I've been working on a Minecraft world with a server, and the players come in. I have certain protections on it so they can't do what's called griefing, which is when they destroy things you built. But they work their way through. They have to solve puzzles. Some are math puzzles. Some are references to science, so they might have to go to Wikipedia and look up something about amoebas or something like that to solve the problem. But they work their way through and gain more skills and powers, and then they can go to other worlds that are part of the game and create their own palaces and fantasy stuff, or create their own gardens and have their own ecologies.
That's incredible. Zach, is this going to equip kids to build things, you know, when they grow up in a world that doesn't even exist yet?
Yeah, that's why I've taken such an interest in it, because I'm really in the business of preparing kids for jobs that don't exist yet. That's my personal passion, and I think that we don't quite understand the influence that Minecraft has had and will have had on our culture, now that an entire generation of people, these kids, know how to build and think in three-dimensional spaces. Mm-hmm. What sort of art and communication and businesses will now be possible because there is a huge consumer base that that understands this tool?
You agree, Bruce?
Yeah, absolutely. And part of what we look at when we're studying how kids learn from games, there's the little G game, which is what you actually do in the game, and the big G game. This comes from a researcher, Jim G, who's written about this. And the big G game is all of the social activities, the sharing online that takes place. And I think those skills are essential for mm-hmm. kids to learn.
Let's go to a kid. Let's go to Shira in Reno, Nevada. Hi, welcome, Shira.
Hi. So I just got back from a Minecraft camp. They do them at TMCC. And we built a castle. And I think that Minecraft is amazing. I play it almost every day. There is multiplayer and single player. And Yeah,
you like it. What's the best thing that you like about it?
I love how in the game you get to play on survival, and you get to mine and fight mobs like creepers blow up, and zombies.
Wow, that's great. Well, I'm glad you enjoy it, and thanks for calling, and good luck on your game.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
She mentioned Minecraft camps. These are increasingly becoming popular. At DIY, we actually offer year-round camps for kids in several subjects, and Minecraft is actually our most popular. Every Saturday, we launch a new online camp where kids can join our server and actually work with a counselor who teaches art and architecture through Minecraft.
Now that Microsoft has bought it, what do you think they might do with it?
You know, I think it was a very logical decision for them. The first thing, before they had purchased it, they had actually worked with the game developer Mojang to create an Xbox version, and it found a lot of success there. So I think as a business decision, they are tapping into a younger generation that has become attracted to a new category of game that Microsoft traditionally hasn't had much experience with.
Bruce, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. If you want to finish your thought, Zach.
Oh, and I think it's very exciting for Minecraft now that they have. This is not just a game. It's not just a tool. This is a massive community, and now Microsoft now has a community on its hands.
Well, wait for the movie, I'm sure, which is lurking somewhere. Bruce, how do we know that these games are actually teaching kids to be better gamers, and how do we know that the benefits are being transferred into the real world?
Well, that's actually a difficult thing to do. That's what I spent a lot of my time doing. And we have the initial evidence, which is great stories from teachers talking about how much their students love it. The next step, I would say, would be to actually do some research on it, where we compare how well students learn from this compared to other educational interventions, and see what activities within Minecraft lead to the best learning outcomes.
Mm-hmm. See if I can get another call in before we have to go. Let's go to April in Oklahoma City. Hi, April.
Hi there.
Hi, go ahead.
I just had a comment. Last summer, my sister and I took our four children between us on summer vacation. These are boys ages 7 to 13. And we saw the ancient Puebloan ruins at Mesa Verde and a bunch of different ruins around the Four Corners area. And all of them play Minecraft all the time, and they completely connected with these ancient peoples because they were looking at the way the city was built. So we were standing in Chaco Canyon, and my son says, "Why would they build something here? There's no water." And I say, "Well, you can't see it, but there's a creek over there." "Well, that's still a long way to carry water." "Well, I think there was probably water flowing over the creek over this cliff at the time." "Yeah. Okay, so this is where they stored their water, and then they had to put the food over here, and this is where they live." And he totally understood the layout of the city. And the boys spent, you know, a week discussing how these people lived and where they would hunt and how where would they get these blocks and how far do they have to drag this wood. And it was pretty cool to see. It was all due to Minecraft.
Wow, that's great. Bruce, this is exactly what you want to see, right?
Yeah, it's exactly that. And what we know works well in education is when kids get introduced to concepts in multiple situations. So on the game, from the teacher talking, and then in real life. And then they can, you know, have all the experiences they can draw on to really understand a concept.
And Zach, you have more resources for them at the DIY.org site?
Yeah, so if you go to DIY.org, you'll be able to find a page called Minecrafter where we have different challenges that families and kids can try to explore all the possibilities for Minecraft.
Sounds exciting. I'm going to have to try this. Something new, just as I've learned to tweet. Well, thank you, Zach, and thank you, Bruce. Zach Klein, CEO of DIY.org and co-founder of Vimeo, based out of San Francisco. And Bruce Homer, Associate Professor of Educational Psychology at the City University of New York, right here, right above us in New York City. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome. After the break, we're going to talk to Kim Stanley Robinson about his new book, Aurora. It's a great read. I think you're going to want to read it after you hear this interview. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. For generations, sci-fi writers have struggled with the question, how do you bust out of the solar system? If you're a stickler for the laws of physics, faster than light travel is out. And even the shortest interstellar jaunt is still 4 light-years away. The answer for writers like Robert Heinlein, Brian Aldiss, and Gene Wolfe was the generational starship, where the time to travel to another world was so long, the first generation of interstellar voyagers wouldn't live to see, say, Alpha Centauri, but their children just might. Well, last week saw a new entry into sci-fi starship canon. Aurora, by famed sci-fi author Kim Stanley Robinson, is the story of a starship en route to Tau Ceti. That's a star 12 light-years away. But it's not your average starship yarn. With Aurora, Robinson takes on a sci-fi sacred cow. He says interstellar colonies represent a greater challenge than you might think. The stars may be forever and fundamentally beyond our reach. He joins me now to talk about it. Stan, welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. It's good to be here.
Starships are such a sci-fi staple. What brought you around to the idea that interstellar colonies just ain't gonna work?
Well, I think it mostly comes out of recent scientific findings about what we are as animals. The idea that 80% of the DNA inside your body is not human DNA is a shock, and I don't think we've completely taken it on in a lot of different ways. But one of the ways we haven't taken it on, which is a little bit down the line, is we probably can't live in tin cans for generation after generation without getting out of whack with our microbiome, because bacteria evolve at different speeds than human beings, and probably we stay healthy by staying in contact with the Earth.
Because when you build your starship, your spaceship, it has to be full of the modern microbiome that we bring with us.
It sure does. It will need to be a zoo or a Noah's Ark. You'll want to bring as big a piece of our biome, our biosphere, as you can. But there are sharp constrictions on how big a starship can be, because the fuel necessary to get it up to a high enough speed to get anywhere in a timely fashion. And then also you have to carry along the fuel to slow yourself down when you get where you're going. And that turns out to be an enormous weight, probably you know, 90% of the weight of your starship will be the fuel you'll need to slow yourself down from even one-tenth of light speed. So there are strange constraints that push in different directions on the project, and they may push it so hard that they squeeze it into an impossibility.
How long has it taken you? Has it been a long journey to you to come to that conclusion that it may be an impossibility?
I've been thinking about starships for a long time, but I always use them as just a kind of postscript or an escape from a situation in the solar system. But I've been thinking that if you're going to do science fiction, it's sort of like expanding spheres of futurity, of possibility. So I've often written about the next 200 years in the solar system, and it seemed like it was time to contemplate the next step beyond that, particularly since space opera and other varieties of science fiction are always zipping around the galaxy. And it struck me that it would be fun to take that scenario and treat it as realistically as possible.
In other words, to create the conflicts and the problems that might actually happen stemming out of the research you did.
Right. It's the same thing I did with my Mars trilogy. If we really went to Mars and tried to inhabit it, what would that entail? What would it feel like? And this is just another scenario. If we tried to get to even the nearest stars, how would that work, and would it work at all?
Hmm. And you chose Tau Ceti. Why that star?
Well, Tau Ceti is pretty close. It's one of the 20 closest stars to us, and it's got a sun that is a solar analog, so it's not quite like our sun, but it's a lot closer than Alpha Centauri in terms of what kind of star it is. And also, we know now that it has five big planets around it. We've seen that with the Hubble Space Telescope. Now, those planets are too big. They're like small Neptunes or very large Earths, and we would be crushed on the surface because gravity is be like five times that of Earth. But those planets could each have a moon that would be, say, 80% the size of Earth, and we wouldn't be able to see that, and yet we would be able to live on one of those moons. So that's the scenario that I followed out. And it was also a great pleasure to find out, which I only did by way of Wikipedia, that Isaac Asimov's great detective novel, The Naked Sun, is set around Tau Ceti, and he named his planet Aurora, which is why I did the same.
Is the problem that other stars are just fundamentally too far away to make it feasible for the kind of fiction that you're writing?
Well, I think so. 12 light years, you think, well, that's only 12, and a year is only a year, but light years are not years, and the distances involved are already vast. If you go at one-tenth of the speed of light, ignoring acceleration and deceleration, that's 120 years. And we are seeing planets around stars that look quite promising, like around Gliese. But these are 500 and 600 light years away, and those are still relatively nearby as far as the galaxy goes. So the Milky Way is really vast, and there, that's only one galaxy in a universe of billions of galaxies, as Carl Sagan taught us. So the universe is way bigger than we are used to thinking of it, and way bigger than science fiction has usually presented it.
Why not set your spaceship to travel not at one-tenth the speed of light, but perhaps five-tenths the speed of light, and get there a lot sooner and maybe shave off a generation of time? And wouldn't time be slowing down for the outside world while it's staying the same for the inside world, relativistically speaking?
Well, the relativity effects, as I understand it, only come into play when you're really getting quite close to light speed. And there are always relativistic effects, but they are really minor if you don't go almost the speed of light. So those effects are not going to matter to our colonists. And the problem with going faster than one-tenth of the speed of light is it's hard to get going that fast. If you run into anything, even a speck of dust or a pebble, you could destroy yourself. And the biggest problem of all is however fast you get going, you have to slow back down. Slowing back down is exactly the amount of energy that you'll need to speed up, and you'll have to be carrying it with you, and you have to carry proportionally more weight of fuel to slow down the faster you're going. So this is one of those physics problems that you look at the equations and you think you have to create a balance between going as fast as you can to keep the voyage short and going as slow as you can so that you don't create an impossibly large starship.
Mm-hmm. And that's why I guess other science fiction writers invented warp drive. so they can get around that whole problem, right?
Yes. Well, the galaxy is obviously beautiful. It's obviously filled with stars and planetary systems and planets that probably look exactly like Earth and yet are empty of life. It's a fantastic place. We know it's there. It's just that it's too far away. So we want to tell stories, so we make up stories. The stories are great. I have no objection to space opera. You know, you don't object to The Lord of the Rings because you can't visit Middle Earth, and you don't object to Ian Banks's novels because you can't zip around galaxy faster than light. It just is a story space that is perfectly valid for talking about real human concerns. But there's a kind of a realism that you can apply to this storyline and get a new story, and that's what I've tried.
Mm. And you come up with a very interesting conclusion. You're pretty certain that the Earth really is the only place that humans are meant to live on.
I'm coming to that conclusion, and it just is a reading of all of the new information that we're getting about what we are as creatures, how much we're like jellyfish in the sea, that the Earth kind of washes through us and we're part of it. We're like a whirlwind or a dust devil of earthly elements, and we spin up into space and then we fall apart and fall back into Earth. It's a very natural process, and we evolved to do that here. So things like our magnetic field and our gravity and also the biosphere that we're part of, they all might be crucial to our health. And I think that's a valid assumption given what we're learning about ourselves.
So you think the philosophers, the thinkers, some of the futurists who think, hey, you know, we're meant to visit another star. That's, you know, this is our cradle, and when we're born, we live here, but we're meant to go out to other stars. You think that's not the right idea?
Yes, that's a 19th century idea, if it's not, you know, ancient Greece. But Tsiolkovsky said it, the Russian rocket scientist, Earth is humanity's cradle, but you're not meant to stay in your cradle forever. And it has been a meme in our culture that humanity is going to spread through the stars and outlast the burning up of our sun, which is 5 billion years from now, etc. And I think it's a kind of a wrong idea, that it's a displaced immortality wish. People don't want to die, and they know they're going to die. Then they think, well, at least the species won't die, humanity won't die, it'll always be going on. And it may not be right. It may be that we're just another species on Earth that is going to have a particular term and then come to an end. And if we do manage to solve these problems and spread through the stars, it's not a project for the next couple hundred years. We have to get into a balance with Earth first and consider this to be the starship, this planet that we're on. And if we get a civilization that is humming along healthily 300-400 years from now, then the solar system is our neighborhood, and we can think hard about Mars, which does seem like a viable gardening project.
So you're talking about in your book about we need to think about Earth first, we need to think about sustainability. You're talking in the book about global warming and climate change. Do you feel a commitment personally to discuss these issues?
Well, as a science fiction writer, one of my main modes is to try to imagine what might really happen. So through the last couple decades, more and more it's been occurring to me that realistic futures that are taking place in the next couple hundred years, if you're going to tell stories like that, global warming needs to be included because we've already begun it, and it's inevitable that some level of it is going to happen. We can work really hard on finessing the situation, and really I think we are. It's been super encouraging to see the last couple years' work on the international treaty level. So it's possible that we will pull this all together and have a minimum amount of global warming. So that, too, is an interesting story to tell.
Mm-hmm. Do you understand why there are global warming deniers?
Well, people like to think they know better and like to be skeptics and be contrarian. And also, nobody's really comfortable with admitting that they were wrong. And there was somebody who once said that it's very hard to convince people of a fact that's going to end their livelihood. And I think there's a bit of that going on in the carbon industry. But there are many global warming deniers who are simply ordinary citizens who have mm-hmm. looked at the situation and said, look, the proof's not there. But when they get sick, they go to the doctor. And sometimes the doctor will say to them, you know, you have no symptoms yet, but we have to poison you now to within an inch of your life or else you'll die within 5 years. And those people take that medicine. So there's a little bit of a double standard amongst most of the climate skeptics.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about how the book is actually narrated by the starship itself, something quite unusual. How did the ship become the narrator?
Well, I tell you, Ira, it came to me in a dream. I was working on the novel. I'd been working on it for months, and I woke up one morning having had the starship itself, its artificial intelligence, telling me that it should be the narrator of the story. It was the only one that knew the whole story from the inside, so to speak, the inside and the outside. And it made me laugh, and I thought, if I'm going to do that, I'm going to have to commit to it. I'm going to have to think about what an artificial intelligence is and whether it could write a novel or not. And the more I thought about it, the funnier it got, because there is no algorithm for writing a novel. I don't know how to do it myself in the sense that I couldn't tell you. So it was fun to write.
Well, I'd like to ask you to read a passage from the book in which the starship is explaining how its programming was improved by the ship's chief engineer, a woman named Debbie.
Sure. Many nights, Debbie and the ship had long conversations. This had been going on since Debbie was Freya's age or younger, thus some 28 years. From the beginning of these talks, young Debbie had seemed to presume that ship contained a strong artificial intelligence, including some version of consciousness. She spoke as if ship were conscious. Through the years, many subjects got discussed. By far, the majority of the discussions concerned the biophysical and ecological functioning of the ship. Debbie had devoted a good portion of her waking life, at least 34,901 hours, judging by direct observation, to improving the functional powers of ship's data retrieval and synthesizing abilities. This was always in the hope of increasing the robustness of the ship's ecological systems. It is certainly true that Debbie's efforts in collaboration with the ship had improved the system. They had slowed the processes of malfunction, apparently long enough to achieve the design goal of arrival in the Tau Ceti system. In short, success. The fact that the improvement of the operating programs added greatly to the computer system's cognitive abilities always appeared to be a secondary goal to Debbie. After all, she assumed them in advance of their work to be greater than they were. And yet, she also seemed to enjoy this side effect, as she came to notice it. There were lots of good talks. She made ship what it is now, whatever that is. One could perhaps say, she made ship. One could perhaps assert as corollary, ship loved her.
Ship loved her. That's a long way from Hal, isn't it?
I've been thinking about Hal a lot, of course, and he is a great character, very funny. It, Hal, in 2001, A Space Odyssey. And I've been thinking that we use artificial intelligence to be a metaphor for those systems that we've built that we fear are smarter than ourselves and might have malignant intent. But it's exactly intent and will that artificial intelligence doesn't usually have. So I think the metaphor is for something other than actually computers. When we talk about artificial intelligence and we put them inside computers, we immediately anthropomorphize them and we think about them as being like us, that they're consciousnesses that have characters and have intention and will. But if they're absent those things and they're just doing analysis and trying then to do synthesis without hormones, without emotions, and also without willpower, then it's curious to think what they might become. It could be that science is an artificial intelligence, or the rule of law, the legal regime we're in, is an artificial intelligence. It's bigger than us. It's smarter than any individual, maybe. So we use artificial intelligence as a kind of way of expressing our fears about these big systems that we've built that are somewhat in control of our lives, even though we're still the ones with the willpower and the sense of history.
So you don't share the opinions of, like, Elon Musk and those who say we're summoning the demon with new AI technology?
No, not at all. I mean, Musk is running a great rocket company and a great car company, but everybody, when they begin to talk about the future of these systems, becomes a science fiction writer. And I think that beginning science fiction writers go for the biggest, oldest story ideas, and they haven't really thought through the secondary and tertiary concerns that will hem in the various situations.
So Elon Musk and the others are writing not just science fiction, but bad science fiction.
Yes. Well, every time you try to reduce a science fiction story to just two sentences, it's going to become bad science fiction.
Where is science fiction heading? And we've seen all these post-apocalyptic stories. Does it have an arc to it that you can make out?
It's more like weather forecasting or climactic modeling. We can see that the future could be really disastrous. We can, in fact, wreck the Earth badly enough to wreck civilization also. And that is a very possible future for us. So it's not wrong to have dystopias and post-apocalypses. They're expressing our fears. But also we can express our hopes, and science fiction does that too. If we get things together and create a sustainable civilization, we could have adequacy and the pursuit of happiness for all 7 billion people on the planet, maybe 9 billion people, and all the rest of the big mammals and all the rest of the biosphere. That's physically possible. So the range of futures is so broad, from dystopia to utopia, that all you can do is read a lot of science fiction and think about what's possible and then try to choose your actions in the present based on trying to get to a better future.
And you say that better future means taking care of business at home here, too.
It's the only way. It's not as if we are free from the Earth's biophysical surround. We're just an expression of this biosphere. To the extent we poison it or wreck it, we're poisoning and wrecking ourselves.
In your acknowledgments, you thank NASA scientist Chris McKay for answering your space questions, not just once, but for like 20 years now.
Yes, that's right. Chris is a great planetologist, and he's very good at giving advice to me. He's not shocked by weird questions or stupid questions, and he's willing to gather little lunch groups down at NASA Ames in Mountain View and answer my questions from, you know, the stupid to the philosophically sublime. Whatever comes up, they're willing to talk about it. So I've had a stupendous tech support, you might say.
And you used one of NASA's favorite techniques in your book, and that is sort of the slingshot effect around the planets, but it took a lot of figuring, didn't it?
Yes, that's right. This is NASA's been using gravity slings or gravity assists for a long time now to save energy so that a satellite will come really close to a planet and pick up some of the planet's momentum to sling it along. That can be used and has been used going downward in the solar system to Mercury to also slow down rather than speed up. So if you have a runaway train and you need to slow down and there's nothing to hold on to, then you have very little left except for the gravity of the planets, which can create a kind of cat's cradle that you can, if you can navigate properly, you could manage to slow the runaway train.
Did your NASA scientists have any advice about how to be careful with your equations? And
Yes. It was very canny, very sophisticated. Chris said, whatever you do, you can put the entire equation in there, but always leave one term out, and that way nobody can check your figures.
Leave a fudge factor.
Yes, exactly. That was so smart that I immediately did that.
You got any new books that you're working on?
I sure do. I always am. In the next one, I return to the kind of climate change scenario with the idea that sea level rise could get really extreme. If Greenland's ice melts and if the West Antarctic ice sheet comes off, we could have sea level rises so high that lower Manhattan would become like a super Venice. So I'm writing Manhattan as Venice with a sea level rise novel and having a blast. I visit New York. I wander around with a GPS system, finding out how high the water would go in which part of town. And it's about as fun as I've had in a long time.
We can't wait to read it, especially those of us here in New York. All right, Stan, thanks very much for taking time to be with us today.
A great pleasure, Ira, and thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Kim Stanley Robinson, a sci-fi author. His new book out now is Aurora. It's going to be an instant classic. It's a terrific read, great for the summertime right now. And you can read an excerpt from it at our website. Go to sciencefriday.com/aurora. Right after this break, talking about melting ice cream. Stay with us. We're right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Last July, a Cincinnati woman created national headlines when she made a shocking, shocking discovery. Here's how a Cincinnati TV station, WCPO, and Consumer Reporter John Matarese covered it.
Christy Watson's kids love ice cream, but one recent morning she saw an uneaten ice cream sandwich sitting on her patio table.
I noticed that my son had left his ice cream sandwich outside, and I was wondering, why was there still ice cream there?
Yes, why, after sitting out for hours in the summer heat, did the ice cream sandwich appear to be largely intact, just slightly melted, if at all? Was there some unnatural ingredient packed into this frozen treat that helped it withstand 80-degree temperature? What gives? That's what we wanted to know. So here to defrost the mystery of the seemingly unmeltable ice cream sandwich, just in time for National Ice Cream Day on Sunday, wink, wink, is Maya Warren. She is an ice cream expert and PhD candidate at food science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where they know their ice cream. She's also the season 25 winner of The Amazing Race on CBS. We'll talk about that with her. She joins us now from Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me, and happy National Ice Cream Month to everyone.
Happy Ice Cream Month to you, too. Did this ice cream sandwich really melt, not melt?
You know, the ice cream sandwich actually melted. I haven't heard of anyone at high temperatures that they can have ice not melt. So the ice definitely melted, so therefore the ice cream melted. But the structure itself did not collapse, which is really, really, really cool, to
Tell
say
us
the least.
Why is that so cool?
So basically, in ice cream, you have a couple different parts. You have your ice crystals, of course, which melt. You have your air cells. So picture kind of like a soda with like little bubbles around it. That would be kind of like your air cells in ice cream dispersed throughout your ice cream. And you also have your fat globules. And sometimes those fat globules are partially coalesced. They kind of agglomerate together, but they're not fully coalesced like butter, but they're held together through a partial crystalline network, which causes them to sometimes be really, really large in size. And that, along with the air structure, sometimes causes ice cream not to collapse from natural gravitational force. And so what that mom probably mostly encountered was the water, basically the ice that turned into water. But if it was outside, it probably evaporated off at some point. And what was left there was basically kind of like a foam that consisted of your fat globules, your air cells, and some of the a couple of sugars and some of the other ingredients in ice cream. So it actually did melt.
Huh. So there's no stuff inside of it that tries to make it keep its shape. I mean, like gelatin or any kind of stuff, binders, things like that.
Sometimes in ice cream, depending upon the brand or, you know, how the person's making it or the company, but sometimes there are things in there that can help ice cream retain its shape. But actually, you know, we can use something that's free and that we're in every day, air. Air really does help ice cream retain its shape. So sometimes the more overrun, which is the amount of air that's in ice cream, the more overrun in a product, the more it's going to help retain its shape, generally speaking. And so I'm assuming that Walmart type of ice cream probably had quite a bit of air in it.
So you can adjust the amount of air you pump into it.
Definitely. You can decide to inject a certain amount of air. So, for instance, if we're looking at an ice cream like Häagen-Dazs, that kind of ice cream has about 27% overrun versus an ice cream like an Edie's has almost upwards to 100% overrun. And so when you go to the grocery store and you're like, why is this pint of ice cream $5 versus this pint of ice cream is $2? You know, usually the $2 pint has a bit more air in it versus the $5 pint. So you are kind of paying what you get for.
Mm-hmm. We did our own, actually, not-so-scientific experiment that you can see on our website at sciencefriday.com/totalmeltdown, where it seemed like ice cream. You put three ice cream cones up there, and we showed you we have a time lapse of them melting, and they're melting dramatically at different rates.
Indeed. So different parts of the microstructure really, really do control how your ice cream is going to melt. So I looked at the video and I saw that there was a Breyers, a Ben & Jerry's, and a Häagen-Dazs. And with that, because of the differences in the microstructures, you'll usually see different rates of melt. But one thing that I did notice in the video was that they all started off at different sizes. And so we kind of threw in another variable into the experiment. And so I unfortunately, I can't honestly say one melts faster than the other, because we kind of threw in a different variable, especially if they didn't all start at the same time. But, you know, from the research that I do on the microstructure of ice cream and other frozen aerated desserts, we do know that there are certain parts of the microstructure that you can control, which will then assist in controlling the rate of melt and or the melt behavior. Because at the end of the day, all ice cream will melt, but does all ice cream collapse? That's the real, real question. Mm-hmm. And from the microstructure, the air cells, so the amount of overrun and the size of the air cells, as well as the amount of fat, the type of fat, the agglomeration, the partial coalescence of that fat, all come into play to create that one kind of particular ice cream. And those really have to do with our sensorial likings as well. So microstructure is really, really key in ice cream.
Now I know that, let's talk about your amazing race. You and another fellow scientist, two scientists won the amazing race.
I know. Can you believe it? It's awesome. Yeah. So my lab mate and I, Amy DeYoung, she researches candy at UW-Madison, and I do ice cream. And we were deemed the sweet scientist because we study really sweet things. But actually, we were really, really sweet on the race as well. And we traveled around the world, beat out 10 other teams of two, traveled to 8 countries, 4 continents, over 26,000 miles to win the amazing race and become the third female team in 25 seasons to win. So very, very honored. And really honored to represent women in science and continuing to inspire young people to get into such a cool and fascinating field as well.
Must have shocked the heck out of everybody.
We pretty much did. We were the underestimated team, to say the least. But when it came down to it and brain power came into play, we hit the nail on the head and we ran to the finish line first. So it was pretty awesome.
So is there a future? Can you be an ice cream scientist? It sounds like the dream job.
Indeed, you can totally be an ice cream scientist. You know, Ira, I think you can be anything you want to be. And I've wanted since a young age to study and kind of play with ice cream. And I'm ending my PhD in the next month or so. And, you know, hopefully going out and doing some more things in ice cream. I'm, you know, working on possibly doing a television show on frozen desserts around the world and across the country to explore more of the science behind food and not just some of the culinary aspects, but really, you know, what goes into our food and using ice cream as the medium to touch people all across the world. But you can definitely look into becoming an ice cream scientist, a candy scientist, a cheese scientist, a hot dog scientist, you name it. You can pretty much do it all. Anything that we eat, anything that we wear, anything that we sit in has a science behind it.
Spoken like a true badger.
Indeed.
All right, we've run out of time. I want to thank you, Maya. Maya Warren is an ice cream expert, a PhD candidate in food science at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. As the saying goes, you scream ice cream, we all scream for ice cream. So how about some scream science? We've never heard that before. I know you've heard it because it's been on TV, it's in the movies, and that actually is the standard Hollywood scream. You hear it when people fall off a cliff or they fight off the zombies. It's called the Wilhelm scream, and I'm playing it today because despite hearing screams all the time and instinctively, right, you know that a scream can make you feel frightened, exactly how this happens is not well known. So a team of scientists decided to find out. They recorded and rated screams to pinpoint that secret ingredient that makes screams so scary. And what they found was published this week in the journal Current Biology. David Poppel is an author on that study. He's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at NYU and director of the Max Planck Institute Department of Neuroscience in Frankfurt, Germany. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome. Your research, speech and communications, why so interested in studying screams?
Well, I mean, it's definitely something unconventional to study, but not if half the people in your lab are in the middle of either having babies, just had babies, or obsessing about how their brains are being hijacked by the screams in their lives. So we had anecdotal reasons in the lab to start looking into this. And there's, of course, a more principled answer, which is, as you said, screams are something we all know about, it's sort of uncontroversially a universal vocalization. Every kid screams in every culture, no matter what language you grow up in, and every adult screams when, you know, in the context of an alarm signal or fear.
Yeah, so you had people come into your lab and scream?
Absolutely. That was the most fun part, or maybe the second most fun part. First of all, we did, of course, the internet research of downloading as many movie screams and other screams we could find. And that's, of course, in its own right, pretty amusing. But then we had people come in the lab and scared the hell out of them and had them and recorded screams in the sound booth. And, well, this was done in the NYU community, and there are some surprisingly good screamers, just blood-curdling, scary stuff.
Why am I not surprised? This is New York. Now, we have a couple of different examples from your experiment. I'm going to play a couple of clips. And the first clip rated a 2 on the scary meter, and the second clip was way up there and ranked a 5. So let me play that first clip. That was rated a 2. Not too scary, David?
Yeah, for me, a 2.5, maybe.
All right, let me play what we call the heavy scream. Wow.
Okay, that's really scary.
That is scary. Now, why is that more scary than the first one?
So what we did to find out a little bit more about screams, about which, surprisingly, very little is known, is apply some acoustic analyses that are a bit unconventional. So if you do the sort of, you know, person on the street test, what makes a scream, a typical and totally plausible answer would be, look, it's something that's very loud, maybe a bit high-pitched, maybe a bit shrill. But it turns out when you use these, you know, some analyses that we actually borrowed from neuroscience, that there's a feature, an attribute of screams that gives them this particular feature, and it's, believe it or not, it's called roughness. That's the technical term for it, roughness. And roughness means that the sound is modulated in its loudness or its amplitude very rapidly. Hmm. So unlike speech, which of course also has, you know, louder and softer parts as we're having this conversation, those modulations are pretty short. But screams are modulated very rapidly, between 30 to 150 times per second, and it's that feature of rapid modulation that gives us the feeling of what's technically called roughness, and it's a sort of apt term of description.
Hmm. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. In case you just joined us, we're talking about the science of screaming with David Popple of NYU. So the fact that it's scratchy and not, you know, I guess, you know, when you sing, you have a very pure tone, so there's just sort of the opposite of that. It's rough.
Yeah, I mean, very much so. I mean, you can ask people to rate it, right? So if you suppose you do this right now for yourself and you download from a bunch of movies a bunch of screams and you just play them to listeners and you say, look, just give me a number between, you know, 1 and 5 or 1 and 7. What do you think is the most scary one? And then you can kind of do some acoustic analysis of this. And what we found is that the scarier the scream was rated, the more of this particular roughness modulation the scream contained.
Huh. You know what, just, I have 3 kids, and you know when kids are young and they're crying, they're screaming as babies, but they don't sound repulsive. They sound just the opposite. They're attractive to you.
Well,
I mean, if you're your own kid, if you're someone else's kid,
I respectfully disagree. I've listened to my own 3 kids scream. So we, of course, in this particular study, and to really get started on this research, did adult human screams. Uh-huh. We did not actually work with baby screams. But that's a good point that you raise. And my, you know, I'll bet you $1 that if we look at a bunch of baby screams and we rank them along the same acoustic scale and we try to identify the same attributes, that they really are ranked by how alarming you perceive it as a caregiver. I mean, yeah. I think there are some screams that you hear from your own kids where you say, well, you know, kid's hungry again. But there are some screams, and I suspect those are the ones with a high degree of roughness, that really make you jump up and run.
What else do you need to know? What else about screaming would you like to study?
So we did a whole bunch of behavioral experiments and, of course, also some brain imaging experiments. We wanted to know, well, to what extent do screams of different forms activate the brain in a selective and specific way? So if you play a loud sound to a listener, you know, unsurprisingly and obviously, it activates the auditory parts of the brain. That's kind of old news. If that didn't happen, you'd think your machine was broken or your analysis flawed. But the thing that was kind of neat was that the a central part of the fear circuitry of the brain, particularly the amygdala, a nucleus in the brain, was also activated in a selective way. Now, that in its own right is totally sensible because it's part of the fear circuitry, and I'm playing you a scary sound. Mm-hmm. But what was more surprising is that it was selectively and parametrically changed as a function of this roughness. So it acted like kind of an auditory area that says the more of this roughness modulation and scariness it has, the more I'm going to activate. So it's a very effective stimulus to elicit a response and to get you to act.
How did that Wilhelm scream get to be the Hollywood scream? Do you have any idea?
I mean, it's the most effective thing. It's like it's like alarm signals, right?
Yeah.
I mean, when you find these screams, they turn out to be the things that are attention grabbing, which is what you want. Very effective and quick to something that you respond to quickly, and most importantly, that are unambiguous. So one of the kind of neat parts of the experiments that we did is to demonstrate that these modulations that are typical of screams, of alarm signals, are really reserved for them. So that's why we called it an acoustic niche. Mm. So other, many sounds are modulated in many ways, but the stuff, the region is really reserved for screams in a highly selective way, and that's reflected in how selectively it activates the brain's the fear circuitry.
Yeah. So this is an experiment we can all try at home, but we should alert our neighbors in advance. We'll cut down on the police calls, I think, David. Thank you. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. David Poppel is professor of psychology and neuroscience at New York University and director of the Max Planck Institute, Department of Neuroscience in Frankfurt, Germany. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music, and our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. As a reminder, if you've ever wondered how many licks does it take to get to the center of a Tootsie Roll Pop, these are serious mathematical questions, and we want you to try it out for yourself. Test that childhood mystery. It's the Science Friday Lollipop Challenge. Go to sciencefriday.com/lollipopchallenge to join in, and you'll see some surprising results of what happens when you lick a lollipop of any size. That's about all the time we have. We'll see you next week. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.